And welcome to minute 152 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we hoobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham Movie A Day and the Shepherd of the Lambcast. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Glad to be back for another episode. Looking forward to talking.
Minute 152 begins with Miller looking around and still in a daze, and ends with Miller once again trying to stand up. You know, it's I wonder if someone who like doesn't see this in context will just think that he's just completely drunk. You know, because of the way that he's acting, despite the fact that he is wearing army fatigues. That's the one.
And he's got blood on his face, you know. I guess if you were falling down drunk, you could get blood on your face pretty easily.
But, I know people who return home with bloody noses because they fell when they were drunk. You know, I haven't experienced that myself, thankfully, but I do know people that has happened to. So it's not.
I don't think this will be the clip that people make into a meme about being drunk.
Probably not. especially with all the debris in the background, stuff like that. You never know. So we ended things yesterday with Miller still being, shell-shocked from the tank missile that took out part of the building next to him. You know, he sort of cleaned himself off from the debris, but his hearing is still a little bit out of it, which means that he's a little off keel, off balance the whole time. So he's, looking around, trying to figure out what's going on. And then we get a very straight. This is a shot that has always completely thrown me for a loop. We get a shot of, young Jimmy Ryan in the fetal position, basically screaming instead of fighting. You know, but just yesterday, or not yesterday, just last on Friday, we saw him fighting. So at this point, it's just very strange that they're depicting this character this way. You know, if he would have been this way the whole time in, you know, during the battle, I could believe it a lot more. But for them to show it here, I don't know. Do you buy it? Do you think that Ryan has turned into a coward?
Well, he hasn't turned into a coward. He's reacting to the fact that they are suddenly overwhelmed. I got the impression that he is out of ammo and under fire, and he has seen, you know, the people that have come for him, you know, basically be killed for the most part. And, you know, he's turned around and, you know, he's shouting out in anguish, kind of covering up. I didn't get the sense that the fetal position was all fear-based, although there is some of that. I would certainly be afraid if I was in that situation, if I was about to be overrun by tanks and German soldiers and had no way to fight back. I could see why you might holler in anguish and crawl up into a ball. There are explosions going on all around you. You can't defend yourself against bombs and explosions, so it's just how do you react in that situation, especially if you can't dive into a, he hasn't made it to the Alamo, so he doesn't really have the opportunity to hide behind anything. So the best he can do is kind of, you know, reduce himself as a target the best he can. Hope for the best.
Okay.
That's the way I look at it, because I don't think he was ever cowardly. I just think he was just going, you know, at that point, he's desperate.
He's desperate, but again, I would like to believe that a soldier, you know, who just was fighting in a battle will overcome this type of, that the adrenaline will give him some form of trying to do something, you know, as opposed to just breaking down and crying in the middle. That's my issue with it. You know, I expect something completely different.
Well, you know, Miller is not being able to do anything, and he's in the same situation. He just got bombarded, and he's not picking up his gun immediately. He's, you know, it takes him a second to get his bearing. So
he's not shooting.
I'm not sure. We don't see it for very long. We don't, you know, look, Ryan is immediately under fire there. So, you know, but if you want to think of him as being shell-shocked and unable to respond, that's perfectly okay with me.
I think the idea here is for, you know, for us to get Miller's perspective of everyone around him. You know, so on the one hand, we see Ryben shooting, and, you know, then we see the way that Ryan is reacting to the whole thing. And then, you know, Miller gets closer to the camera and says, Mike. And, you know, at a certain point, then they let us see, you know, Mike, and there's just, you know, there's deadness in his eyes. You know, Tom Sizemore does a nice job there of making us believe that Mike has now succumbed to his wounds. But Miller is very shocked about this whole thing. So, you know, back to the...
Did you have the impression that Ryan's on the other side
of
the
bridge? No, he's with them. Remember, Ryan helped...
I know he's not supposed to be more than 2 feet away, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's always 2 feet away. I'm just trying to remember what the distance looked like.
He helped Mike after Mike was shot to get to the position of where he is right now. You know, all three of them are on the other side of the bridge.
I don't remember that, so I'm not saying it's not true. That was probably in an episode, or that was probably in a minute that I only saw once yesterday and haven't reviewed six times.
It was in the it was in the very beginning of yesterday's episode. You know, so it was in yours, Richard.
Now I have to go back and look.
Yesterday we were talking about short-term memory, so there you go.
Immediately after that, there is movement. I'm sorry, we're going backwards here.
Fine.
In minutes. Across the bridge, and two soldiers are moving back across the bridge. One of them is distributing the cord that it looks like it's for detonator.
That's Miller and Ryben. But all four of these guys have made it across the bridge.
They're all, yeah, but like I said, I couldn't make out who is moving the cord. That's Miller.
And Ryben is giving him cover fire with his BAR.
Anyway, back to where we were in the current minute.
So Miller now moves. Yep.
We've got Miller laying next to the sergeant who's dead.
Mike is not there. He just screams at him, Mike. And then Ryben grabs him and pulls him out of there just to get him in, you know, out of the line of fire. You know, once again, Ryben was shooting, and the next thing he's doing, he's trying to help Miller. And he like throws him down behind the sandbags. And Miller is still out of it and still looks back at Mike, and then he looks to the other direction and he sees the detonator contraption. I don't know what it's called, really. The pump, the trigger. Okay, trigger. And so he sees it in the distance, and he sees that the little piece that fits into the top that you turn in order to, you know, cause the explosion has fallen out. And then we get another shot of a whole bunch of German soldiers advancing towards their side of the Alamo. And we see that there's a lot of them. And then, lo and behold, we get to see that Steamboat Willie is actually among them. For anyone who's forgotten, Steamboat Willie is the German prisoner from the radar tower who eventually they eventually let him go. But here he shows up again, and he's right there, back in his unit, just like Ryben had said that he would be doing. You know, we're just going to let him get back into, you know, meet up with another group and a group of soldiers and just rejoin the fight, which is what they did. So even in this moment, we can see that, Miller's on his last legs, but we know Miller made a mistake by allowing or for having too much confidence that Steamboat Willie was actually going to do what they told him that he should be doing.
Have you, I assume that you discussed it when you were in that minute about whether or not it was the right thing to do and what the potential consequences were going to be. You know, it's a moment of irony that we get Steamboat Willie being the shooter in this particular case. But the truth of the matter is that there were a dozen other German soldiers there with rifles pointed in that direction. I don't think that Captain Miller would have been spared if Steamboat Willie hadn't
Probably
been
there. Probably not, but that's not the point. The point is that the guy who makes the...
No, I know the point is the irony that, it's, you know, we're supposed to feel that this was an obvious mistake. I'm, like I said, you guys probably talked about that before. I don't know that it's an obvious mistake. It's an attempt to do what is the moral thing. Is there a consequence to it? Well, there's a consequence to every decision that you make, you know. What's the consequence if they had killed him?
Of course. I mean, there's that's the whole idea.
Yeah. I don't think the ultimate outcome would have been any different.
You think that someone still would have shot Miller? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, because Miller.
They were overwhelmed with the number of German soldiers and a tank facing them. And, you know, the presence or absence of Willie is just a dramatic thing to add some, you know, weight to the order.
Also, we'll give Upham something to do also, you know, from that same perspective. You know, in order for us to see that Upham has changed.
And I'm not, I'm not exactly sure that he would call it a redeems himself. There, that's the word I was looking for, a moment of redemption. I'm not exactly sure you redeem yourself by murdering a surrendering prisoner, even though they might have deserved it.
Okay, but again, the question that this movie asks is okay, if you're in that type of situation, what do you do?
Oh, yeah. And what would people have done and what did they do?
You know, we know that there were many cases where, you know, people chose the other answer, you know, and it's hard to know which one. That's right.
Earlier.
We're not sure which is the right answer or not. And I think that's one of the things that this movie is trying to show that, you know, to put it succinctly, war is hell. There's a lot of things that go on, and there's a lot of things that, I mean, well, I'm sure that I'm going to be talking about this next week. You know, once we're back with older Ryan again, but, you know, he doesn't seem like the type of guy who has shared any of this with his family, you know, because it's also traumatic for him, you know, everything that happened here. When we know everything that happened during his battle in Normandy, you know, that type of thing.
War stories that you share with your compatriots. If there was a reunion of a platoon after the war, that's one thing. Sharing the stories with your family, that's, I think, something different. It's harder. It's got to be, you know, like you said, traumatizing and maybe puts you in a situation where you would have to reveal things about yourself that you don't really want people to know about you.
It's true. I mean, you know, I at the end of the season, I have two interviews, which I've already done the interviews. One of them is with the son of one of the guys from Band of Brothers who mentioned that exact thing of what you said, that many of them, you know, did not discuss it with their families. But when they would go to the reunions every year, they had people that they could talk with that understood everything that they had gone through. And the second interview is with a 101-year-old World War II veteran who didn't fight on D-Day. He only landed in Normandy in September of 1944. But, you know, the stories that he tells also, it's the same thing. And I even asked him, and I'm sort of spoiling, you know, my interview with him that people will listen to in a few weeks from now. But I asked him, you know, why some people keep it in and why some people keep it you know, are willing to talk about it. And he said everyone has their own reasons for it. And he sees it that he needs to, you know, tell the story of what happened, that people need to know about it. Because if he doesn't talk about it, people won't know. So he sees it as his mission in life to educate people on what truly happened. You know, that
keep a legacy record, so to speak. Well, my father was a combat veteran from World War II, and he talked about it, his experiences in a very limited way. He served in the Philippines, and he was in the occupying forces for Japan at the end of the war. And I heard maybe one or two stories when I was a kid about his service. But other than, you know, one or two incidents, and they were not combat related. They were related to other things. He didn't talk about it.
When you were older, did you get more stories from him at that point, or?
No. Didn't get into it.
Because you knew he didn't want to talk about it, or because it wasn't something that was.
No, it didn't come up. It was, you know, not a conversational thing. I mean, it could have, but we had other things that we were doing, and it never occurred to me to kind of raise it as a subject. Looking back, I could think that it probably might have been a good thing to do that, but it was not one of those things that occurred to me at the time.
Yeah, once you get that time machine, then you can go back and take care of that.
Yes, exactly.
Keep building that time machine. I know you got that DeLorean, in your garage. So, I have a lot of faith in you that you'll be able to do it. So we see Steamboat Willie partaking in the shooting, and Upham notices him and just starts watching what he's doing. And Upham, as you said, is just part of a long list of a firing squad of people that are, just shooting in the direction of everyone at the Alamo. And it's interesting also, we see some of the Germans actually get hit and fall down, while we're watching all this. But Upham doesn't want to have anything to do with this, and he, makes himself scarce by, basically slouching down even further.
I think he's waiting his opportunity. I know that he is usually viewed as being cowardly. I don't think, except for the moment that he has on the staircase earlier in the film, that he was particularly cowardly. In this particular situation, it's him, and there are 10 guys on the other side of that little ditch that he's hiding in. I could see why you might wait your opportunity.
This time I don't fault him for doing that. he's got a good enough explanation here and a good enough reason to do it. So that's fine. Perfect. And then the shot changes, and we, for the last 2 seconds of this minute, once again get to see Miller deciding that, even though he's disoriented, he's going to start to get up. And then he starts to get up, and the minute ends. As I mentioned yesterday, and I've mentioned numerous times over the last few weeks, I'm keeping count of the Allied soldiers that don't make it through the Battle of Rommel in order for us to get an idea of how many soldiers were there to defend it. And so with Mike's death, so now we're up to 17. Yeah, we're going to see where that number goes, because there's no way of us ever knowing how many men are there to defend Rommel. So unfortunately, this is the only way to keep count. So Richard, did you have anything else you wanted to say about this?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well.
So every Tuesday we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five Tom Hanks performances. So Richard, why don't you once again start with your number five and work your way up? And I know that Jaws will not be on this list.
Yes, because Tom Hanks doesn't appear in Jaws. If he did, I'm sure it would be on the list. Are you kind of keeping track of everybody's lists and going to do a summary about how many times one film appears or another film appears?
How well do you know me?
I know you pretty well. That seems like exactly one of the things that you'll be doing toward the end of the series. All right. Well, I'd be interested to see if anybody else has picked my number five pick here. Larry Crown.
Okay, you want me to tell you if anyone else has picked it? Okay.
Yeah.
No, you are the first person to choose Larry Crown.
All right.
Someone actually said that Larry Crown was their worst, their least favorite.
Yeah, well, I know there are people who dislike the movie. I'm not sure why they dislike the movie. It is a Hanks written and produced and directed film. So I think he does a pretty good job directing himself. The character is an everyman. And I think that that's one of the things that's very appealing about it. Hanks is, you know, kind of reflecting the uncertainty of the economic times and changes that we were going through at the time the film came out. And I thought it was pretty honest in the way it dealt with those sorts of things. And I like, you know, maybe his relationship with Julia Roberts is a little too pat in the film, but I like him, the way he kind of connects with the other students in the classes and gets adopted by some of them as kind of a project for them to work on. And I found that very appealing. So that's why I have it on my list. There are a dozen romantic comedies that I could have picked. I kind of went through the ones that were available. And I picked the one that I think is the most melancholy of all of the Tom Hanks' romantic comedies. And that's Sleepless in Seattle. Because of the performance that he gives when he's on the phone talking to the psychologist and talking about what it was like to be in love with his wife. And I thought that was a really good moment. And the frustration that he has with his son at times, interfering with his attempt to keep living, I thought that was also quite good. So that's why I picked Sleepless in Seattle over some of the other ones that I love quite a bit. My third favorite is Castaway, which, of course, is almost entirely him. I mean, I know there are other people in the movie, but people rarely remember that. Yes, that's it. His co-star is pretty silent. But, you know, he goes through a whole process of, you know, physical changes in the movie. And I think that's pretty taxing. And obviously that means that there's going to be, you know, extra effort and probably get some accolades for that. Number two, I have Saving Private Ryan, which I'm sure everybody has talked about. This is another everyman kind of part, only he's playing somebody who's supposed to be taking responsibility, be in charge. He knows right from wrong and struggles to do the right thing, but also knows that he has to follow orders, and he gets a death scene. So I think that adds a little bit there. And then number one on the list is Forrest Gump, which, you know, I always joked when I was teaching and we talked about vocal variety and the way people judge people on their vocal characteristics. One of the things that I used to joke about was, you know, Tom Hanks won an Academy Award by slowing down his rate of speech by about 30%.
Hey, if it worked.
There's more to that performance than just that, but that's a big part of it. Why not? Yep.
All right. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that. So, Richard, would you like to tell people where they can find Richard Kirkham?
Oh, on a weekly basis, you can find me at the Lamcast, which is the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, which I am the, as you said, the shepherd of. Large Association of Movie Blogs is a collective of, there are 2,000 members, but most of them are not as active as I would like them to be. We have about 150 people who are still relatively active on the site, adding things as we go along during the week. And we have four or five people on the show on a weekly basis talking about recent films. We have specialty projects that we do. We just did a look back to 1971 films. That was quite a bit of fun, and people had some interesting choices there. Also, if you are interested in my personal take on movies, on my personal blog, Kirkham A Movie A Day, my motto is, if I saw it in a theater, you'll read about it here. So I go to the movies pretty regularly. I don't review movies that I see on television or that I watch on streaming for the most part. Once in a while, there's an exception. There, if I'm doing a special project, for instance, like a film festival of older movies, then I might write about an older film. But most of the ones that you'll see on my site are films that are played in a theater. Now, some of them are classic films because I do go to the movies to see classic films on the big screen. If there's a choice between sitting at home and watching a movie or going to the theater and watching the movie, and it's the same movie, I'll go to the theater every time.
That I'm I don't have as many opportunities as you do. I wish I had more opportunities, that's for sure. But yeah, that's we do what we can.
That's it. I'm fortunate where I live. We have, the Alamo Theaters, they have great programming and they're always playing older films. I saw Mulholland Drive, by the way, for the first time just last weekend, and I liked it quite well. I've got a couple of older films coming up in the not too distant future as well. And every summer we have the Paramount Classic Film Series where they run about 70 or 80 classic films from the past, anything from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s is a possibility there. And I go as often as I can.
Very cool. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn it, buddy. Earn it. Solitude, you haunt me with reveries of death.